It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning August 9th, 2024. I'm still reviewing news media from my temporary summer perch in the great state of Maine, a historic state in many ways, one of a half dozen making up New England, one of the original 13 colonies who jointly went to war against the British overlords, leading to America's Declaration of Independence. But history means charting change as well as evoking the past, and as both an electronic media guy and a grateful naturalized immigrant, I'm heartened by a decision made by Maine Public, the entity funded by donations and grants that pumps out its listener-supported public radio and public television across the whole state. What heartens me is that Maine Public now issues a weekly broadcast called News Connect, whose special beauty, yes, beauty, I'll admit my bias here, is that the whole show is made available not only in English, but also French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Somali. There are many Somali farm workers and their families in Maine ever since first arriving around 20 years ago to harvest Maine's signature summer crop, blueberries. Oh, and I should add that News Connect also comes, when viewed online, in the Arabic and Khmer languages as well. Such practical down-to-earth acknowledgement, even celebration of diversity, takes me to the nationwide arena. Thanks to Democratic Party delegates voting Monday in an online roll call well ahead of their national convention, we now officially have, as candidate for the presidency, a woman who personally embodies the long-standing ideal of America as a melting pot. Consider this label given to that top-of-the-ticket candidate by Lydia Palgreen, a New York Times opinion writer. According to her, Kamala Harris possesses, quote, a multi-hyphenate blend of identities, black, Indian, Jamaican, female, American, which is a source of unusual strength. And Palgreen herself knows whereof she speaks, so to speak. As it happens, the writer has her own claim to hyphens, as the daughter of a white American father and an Ethiopian mother. But Harris's being a dramatic new exemplar of multi-hyphenate, or just plain melting pot America, won't of course be enough for her to succeed in November, even with the buttress since Tuesday of a more old-style running mate, the balance-seeking white, male, Midwestern Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota. What signs are there that she and Walz will capture the crucial constituencies that they need and are seeking? Harris's fundamental job has naturally first been to turn out the Democrats' base enthusiastically. That's a given. And then there's the task of winning over potentially supportive Republicans, too. With the latter, Palgreen's reporting in the New York Times is instructive. Despite her sharing of some hyphens with the vice president, Palgreen has generally been a self-confessed Kamala skeptic, and as such she took her unconvinced, open-minded approach to a campaign meeting Harris held at Kalamazoo in deep heartland Michigan. The event was highly staged, of course. Journalists must always be acutely aware of that. But on stage with Harris was a Republican woman, Olivia Troy, who was formerly a national security staffer in both the George W. Bush and Trump administrations. But since then, she became, pretty obviously, an anti-Trumper. Palgreen highlighted the way Harris talked about abortion with Troy, who grew up as a conservative Catholic in Texas, and of course they talked about the overthrow of the Roe v. Wade right to choice for a woman. No one has, Harris said, to abandon their faith or deeply held beliefs to agree the government should not be telling her what to do with her body, right? Palgreen commented that Harris was stressing the right message at the right time in the right context, and delivering it as a deft, common-sense homily. She pointed out that Harris was not pandering to conservatives with the rather customary, often obfuscating language about abortion, I would say mealy-mouthed language, wanting abortion to be, quote, safe, legal, and rare. But she wasn't either making what Paul Green called a maximalist case for abortion. She was instead embracing a restrained stance built squarely on the core theme of her campaign as a whole, freedom. Again, Harris's own words fully conveyed her tactical approach. Quote, if we in this year of our Lord 2024 have a state of being where the government can tell you what to do with your body, I mean the most basic of things you should have control over, everybody better watch out about what other freedoms we could lose. We will be hearing and seeing that message reported again and again in the next 88 days. You know, every 4 years it seems to me that the country's political classes, and that includes political journalists, can't quite believe in their bones that there will be, even in the late stages of a presidential campaign as now, Americans who are undecided about who to vote for. But they do exist. I've met them while reporting in coffee shops, barber shops, town hall meetings, been driven by them in taxis, spoken with them in smoke breaks standing outside building entrances. You've heard them too, in all likelihood, I bet. They do claim not to know how they'll vote in November. Or maybe they just don't want to say. The latest Harvard Center for American Political Studies opinion poll, conducted by Harris Polls, puts the proportion of such undecideds at a striking 28%. A lot of journalistic effort is now laser-focused on assessing what Harris's chances are of making that so-called swing vote swing her way, especially, of course, in the seven swing states. They offer between them a total of 93 Electoral College votes out of the 270 that are needed to win the presidency. In no particular political order, in other words, in alphabetical order, they are Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Of all these, the so-named blue wall states, in this case Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, that were traditionally Democratic until Trump won them in 2016 and then Biden won them back in 2020, are now truly toss-up states. Trump had a small lead there in opinion polls before Harris became the candidate. Now that Trump lead has disappeared. In the other four states, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, loosely the Sun Belt, Trump's previous lead has now shrunk to within the normal statistical margin of error. In these states especially, states with decidedly diverse populations, it's Harris's very evident appeal among younger and non-white voters that's already making a difference. She's not winning in polls there yet, but these states are clearly an appealing target for her campaign. And things will likely be easier for her back in that blue wall. Cephologists are predicting, I really like that term for election experts. I was once my British TV company's in-house cephologist, back in pre-computer days at that, when a very capacious human memory was needed. And for a few years I did have one. Well, the cephologists of today are predicting that if Harris holds Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, plus they say just one congressional district in the Omaha area of Nebraska, that would take her to exactly the magic number of 270 Electoral College votes, without needing any of the Sun Belt states. Such are the hopes that campaign workers harbor, and that the press will inevitably pass on to the public blithely or with some critical assessment, perhaps. And what's the word on Trump? He now really needs to win all of the Sun Belt states where he's been finding favor, and he needs to pick up one of those blue wall states. Winning solely the Sun Belt would get him to only 268, just short of the magic 270. So his campaign's focus has been on Pennsylvania. Action groups that support Trump have spent $50 million there, out of the $85 million or so that they're spending on media advertising nationally. Their second biggest spending has been on Georgia. So if we're going to be simplistic, and what journalist doesn't aim for at least simplicity, the entire contest could well come down to those two states, Georgia and Pennsylvania. If Trump were to win both of them, he would then, as things stand, easily reach the magic 270. It was no surprise, then, that the Democrats' pre-convention barrage this week of barnstorming rallies began in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it would have included this evening Savannah, Georgia, if Tropical Debbie's deluge of rain hadn't put it off to another day. Another day very soon, of course. For this highly time-compressed Harris-Walls campaign, every day must count. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.